The dynamic between humans and rats usually goes something like this. Rats go after people's food, and people do everything they can to keep rats away. In a strange reversal of behavior, a Lawrence man and his colleagues are looking for a rat, a new species of rat. They've identified the species from its bones and teeth. They even gave it a funny name, Rattus detentus. But they haven't had the chance to observe it up close because it's very sneaky. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And today we're going to meet the KU scientist who discovered this creature. Bob Tim, good morning.
Good morning.
This rat, the Rattus detentus, lives on an island off of Papua New Guinea. How is it different from other rats?
It's a good-sized rat, as rats go, and it has very distinctive teeth. The front teeth, the incisors, are really massive. They're good chewing teeth. And the rear teeth, the molars, are crushing teeth. So we believe this rat is consuming really hard seeds that it has to chew to get into, and then it masticates the meat of the seed with those back molars.
So what do other, like the rats that we might unfortunately be more familiar with, how do they eat?
The rats that you see, especially in our cities, are really quite generalist. They're omnivores. So they can eat all kinds of seeds. They love our garbage.
They
love
sure do.
Potato chips and french fries and hamburger that we throw in the garbage. But they'll also eat baby birds. They'll eat a lot of insects. So they're real generalists, whereas we believe this rat is really a specialist.
Does the Rattus detentus exist outside of Manus Island where you found it? Or is that the other place? Is that the only place it exists?
That's the only place it exists. And that's in part why we gave it that unique name. And all species of mammals, all species, have a very unique name so scientists can identify them accurately. And one reason we gave the rat this name is it's been detained on this island for tens of thousands of years.
Now, our listeners might be picking up on some political overtones there, and I do want to talk about that, but I want to learn more about the rat and its discovery, and then we'll go there, okay? So this is the only place this rat exists.
It only exists on Manus Island, yes.
The rat has been called one of the top scientific finds of 2016 by Discover magazine. So obviously the scientific community sees something about it that's really, really significant. What is that?
Well, it's probably a combination of several things. It's something that scientists expected, but the public and the non-specialists didn't really expect. The reason we expected something new to be there is we have a huge number of fossils from one site on this island, and people who occupied this island for tens of thousands of years were capturing them and eating them. And then
how did we know that, though? I mean, you've said that there are fossils, but how can you tell from fossils, like, how people and these rats were interacting?
When people who are cooking, their meals in one place discard what they don't want, we call those midden sites. And in one cave area, there are thousands of teeth and bones from these rats, this one species of rat, in their midden sites. And so we're really quite convinced that the people relied on these for food. But we had no modern specimens up until 2002.
So in 2002, what changed that?
In 2002, two conservation biologists who are colleagues were working with a group of people in northern Manus, and the local people caught two of these rats and ate them. And these our colleagues saved some of the bones for us, and they got sent to me at the University of Kansas, and I immediately recognized it as something new.
Why did they send them to you? I mean, that's a lot of shipping. I mean, why don't they? I mean, are you really the only scientist who can figure out what to make of these bones?
Well, not the only one, but it's a small group of us. And at the University of Kansas in the Biodiversity Institute, we have one of the world's largest collections of mammals. It's the second largest university collection in the world. And so we have specimens from all over. So if you're trying to identify something obscure, what you need to do is compare it to known material. And comparing it directly is better than just reading the published literature, which we did. We put the published literature together with the specimens. And I also traveled to the Smithsonian to look at specimens there.
So wait, you're looking at the remains of rats?
Yes. But not just rats. We are working extensively on the mammals of New Guinea. And so this is one component of that research. So we looked at the bats and we looked at the opossums and the other species that were being consumed by people.
Why are you so interested in the mammals of Manus Island?
Well, I'm interested in mammals of the world. And so this fell within my purview of interest. And I've worked extensively here in North America. I've worked extensively in Central America, South America, and Africa, and was interested in looking at the fauna of Manus Island, especially because it was so poorly known.
Well, I know you're a scientist, and it's probably not your business to judge one mammal compared to another, but a lot of people really don't like rats. And you are, like, going around looking at not just the rats you're forced to confront in life, but, I mean, historic rats. Did any part of you ever think, like, this is kind of a weird thing to do?
No. My mother thought that for a while when I was growing up, is what is this kid going to do with this interest of insects? And I do have to continually thank her for being a very tolerant mother, because I was the sort of kid that would come home with frogs and snakes in my pocket that she had to deal with. So I've been doing this for as long as I've been alive, really.
Both formally and informally.
Formally and informally, yes.
So, you know, back to what we do know about this creature is what? That it's its own species and that it still exists. That's what we didn't know before?
Correct. It's a very unique species that has been isolated on this island. And that in itself is interesting in that many of the rats that you see on the islands of the world are the same species that you see here in the Midwest. The Norway rat is the one that you see running across the streets and in the middle of the night. And that rat was...
I'm glad to know a little more about it.
Well, don't be worried about conserving Norway rats. If you get a chance, just take them out, is my advice. And it's a generalist. So it destroys our food crops. It chews wires. It's really a bad animal to have as commensal with humans.
But what don't we still know about the rat on Manus Island, the Rattus detentus?
Well, there's not very much that we do know other than its anatomy. No scientist has ever seen a live one. And so we just have these preserved specimens.
But if it still exists, why not? You can't just go around an island and, like, I have been led to believe that if you put a dumpster somewhere, you will find a rat.
You're thinking of Norway rats, not a specialist rat like this one. And a scientist, a very, very skilled Australian colleague, worked very hard to try to capture another one of these rats, and he was unable to. So we think it's really not very common at all.
When you discover a species, as we have mentioned, you get to name it. And, I mean, so did you personally get to name this rat the Rattus detentus?
Yes. Well, personally, but it's a joint effort with several colleagues. Another colleague in Lawrence, Kansas, a colleague in Finland, and three colleagues in Australia worked together to describe this species.
It seems like that's a lot of pressure. I mean, I named a person once with another person, and that was a lot of pressure. But you're naming a whole species for all of eternity, and the name you picked out, Rattus detentus, rhymes, and it sounds, the first time you hear it, it sounds a little like someone was kind of kidding.
It was very carefully selected. We went through lots of different names before we hit upon this one. And when you look at a scientific name like Homo sapiens, what you're looking at is a Latin derivative of what the people are trying to communicate. So we're the smart people is who we are.
Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
And Ratus Detentus, you've mentioned that you've hinted anyway that there's a political aspect to this. Can you tell us a little bit about why it's called Ratus Detentus?
Well, the first point I hit upon is the species has been detained on this island. Unlike other rats, it really hadn't traveled between islands on ships, either dugout canoes or modern ships, whereas the roof rat and the Norway rat have. So it's been detained there. Also, Manus Island has a very large detention center for refugees that are trying to get into Australia. And it's the Australian government's detention center for people who they don't wish to come into Australia.
So what do you think is the purpose of giving the rat a name that refers to that predicament for refugees?
It's calling attention to the problem. And it's a problem that 800, 900 people now are essentially in this locked detention center and unable to get out. National Public Radio had an interesting piece on last week about a man who was starving himself to death in this detention center because he saw no hope of ever being released.
So it's an awareness-raising technique?
Yes, it's a very, very much an awareness-raising technique.
But isn't the scientific community at all leery about that kind of thing? I mean, especially at a time when science, like journalism actually, is trying to assert that it's wedded to fact, not opinion, and that facts don't change depending on what sort of politically expedient. So I guess identifying scientists and their discoveries with a political position, I don't know, it seems risky.
We thought very carefully about this. And we consulted extensively with our Australian colleagues. And because of the political situation there and the lack of awareness of this issue throughout the world, we decided to do this this joint, not really a play on words, but one word that both called attention to how long this rat had been isolated on the island and the political situation of people being detained in this center.
So it wouldn't work, you're saying, if there weren't some, like, reason having to do with the rat and its own story?
Correct. Well, a scientist can select the name that they choose, and you need to construct it properly, and you need to very, very accurately describe your new organism if you're going to describe a new species. Then you get to select your species name, and as long as it's properly done, it's available for other scientists to critique in the literature.
But what about the rat? I mean, the rat didn't ask to be politicized.
That is for sure true. And as I said, we've never seen one of these animals alive.
Yeah, so it couldn't ask you.
But the detention center is something very real. And it's something that the world has learned more about in the last week. Because when our President Donald Trump spoke with the Prime Minister of Australia, this was the primary subject of their conversation, is this detention center on Manus Island.
Is there a history of species being named based on what's going on in the world at the time of their discovery? I feel like 100 years from now, when people learn about the Ratus Detentus, assuming like you get your place in the textbooks, they'll also learn about this moment and the international refugee crisis. So in a way, like this moment is connected to this rat forever.
I believe that's a good thing. Our possum that we have that you also see at night when you walk home the species
and react to very similarly to the rat at the dumpster.
You shouldn't. It belongs here in North America. It belongs in the Midwest here. The scientific name of that animal is Didophis virginiana. We're a long ways from Virginia. The white-tailed deer that you
So why is it called that?
It's called that because the first scientists who saw a specimen were not here in North America. It was the French and the British scientists that were given a specimen when the New World was being colonized. So it in Virginia was not just the state that we know it as today. It was given as the name of that land in eastern North America.
But we've mentioned that the rat is not a beloved creature necessarily. Do you think that the rat is the best spokesperson, or does it kind of not matter?
Well, it's a spokesperson, and I won't say it doesn't
matter. Or a spokesmammal, I guess.
A spokesmammal is certainly a more correct use of terminology here. It's a situation that needed to be called attention to. And it's a name that we chose very carefully that worked for both the biology of the rat, the new species of mammals that we discovered, and the political situation.
If you did get to see the Rattus detentis, like if you got to go to Manus Island and you did happen to lay eyes on this thing, what would you be most excited to find out?
Everything about its biology, its color, how it moves, exactly what it eats, where it lives, does it dig tunnels, what are the predators, how many young does it have in the literature, in the litter, how long it lives.
We
really know
questions.
We know nothing about this animal in the living situation.
Bob Timm, Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, thanks for stopping by this morning.
It's been a pleasure. And keep enjoying those possums and deer that you see at night.
Professor Timm's identification of a new species was hailed as one of the top finds of 2016 by Discover Magazine. After the break, a visiting author will talk to us about her novel, The Mothers. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by the author of The Mothers, a new novel that's getting a lot of buzz. Britt Bennett is in town for a reading at the library, and Britt, it's great to have you on our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We'll kind of need to set up the plot of your novel, but before we do that, I just want to say I've been reading The Mothers over the weekend, and it's really good, but not quite in the way that I was expecting, just based on the way people are talking about it. It feels more personal than political. And that's despite the fact that the event that sets the whole plot in motion is an abortion, which politically is not neutral.
Right. Yeah, I think that has been some of the responses I've gotten to the book. People may be expecting a book that's going to be more political than it actually is. And people just connecting to the story on an emotional level more than a political one.
I've heard, let's start off by saying we're going to be getting into really sensitive topics from the get-go. And so if you're like driving around in the car with kids or something, you might want to take that into consideration. But the main character in The Mothers is a teenage girl by the name of Nadia. And she's in a lot of ways just a teenager with a compelling internal life. She's obsessed with a boy she's dating. She's excited about going to college. But her mom has just died. And her grief is complicated by the fact that the death was a suicide. We learn all of this almost immediately. And that's before the abortion. This is a lot to have your readers confront before they really know this girl.
Right. I think as a reader, I'm kind of an impatient reader. So I think as a writer, I like to put a lot of information up front. I like to grab people right away. And I think for me, it was very important that this was not going to be a book that would kind of hedge around some of these complicated issues. I did want to put it up front. And, for no other reason than the fact that if some of the subject matter might bother you, then you can check out early if you realize that about yourself.
What's kind of surprising to me about that is that by not dancing around it, in a way, it takes some of the political power away from it, because you share that information pretty quickly, and it's sort of within these passages that go through, you'll maybe spend paragraphs talking about Nadia watching this boy she likes, the preacher's kid. You know, it sets up what's important to that character.
Right. And I think that I always knew when I was writing the book that this was a choice that she would make. I never envisioned a draft of the book where Nadia decided to keep the child. So I think I always knew that she would decide to terminate the pregnancy. And what really interested me as a writer was the aftermath of that decision. I think that that's something that is often kind of missing from our political discourse about abortion, or is often simplified, in which we assume that a woman has to feel one way or another following this really complicated choice.
Does it surprise you at all that people have seen this as a book actually about race?
A little bit. You know, I think of it as a book in which, you know, the characters are Black and their experiences are inflected by race. But it's not a book in which the plot turns on racism. And I think that there's a way in which that is something that has surprised people, because they think that a narrative with Black characters has to be a narrative that is about racism.
Or about
so
race.
I think the ways in which the reader, I think the ways in which the readers have reacted to that. I think it often says a lot more about what people are expecting as readers than anything not particularly different that I did in this book.
I've read, you know, there are a lot of, I guess, more older African-American writers who have been really excited by the novel and specifically by what they've described as characters who are, quote, ordinary Black people. And
right.
And that has been seen as something exceptional. Did you think it was exceptional while you were writing it, or has that been something that has come up just in the conversation since it's been published?
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, there was nothing exceptional about that to me, because I was writing about communities where I came from and about people like the people that I know. You know, I went to a really diverse school. I grew up in a military town, so I went to school with all kinds of different types of people. And, you know, I think I think that says more about the ways in which narratives about people of color are so oversimplified. The fact that it would be unusual to have a story like this. I think to me that is the telling thing about the reactions from readers. But there was never anything that groundbreaking about it to me, because, you know, I'm an ordinary Black person and all I know are ordinary Black people.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me, because as a white reader who, I mean, Nadia's 17. I spent my teenager years in a pretty white environment, and I wasn't in situations that Nadia's in, but her thoughts and fears and hopes are 100% relatable. I mean, she is a Black character, but there's a whole lot about her that's universal. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, that's the nature of what people's experiences are like. You know, it's like we all live in raced bodies, so we have racialized experiences, and we have ways in which race inflects our perceptions and the ways that we interpret history, for sure. I'm not trying to downplay that, but I think essentially people want a lot of the same things. You know, people want to be loved. People want, you know, to pursue their dreams. And, you know, her dream is to go off to college, and people, you know, she wants to be loved by this boy that she likes. So I think that that's just the nature of life. I think that writing any character, you want to be specific, regardless of whatever their racial background is. It's, you're not writing a Black person. You are writing Nadia Turner and who this character is. And I think that's what you want to do. That's just what good writing is. It's specific. It's particular to a character, and taking into account culture and race, for sure. But I think that that's what you're doing when you're writing a character, and that's what readers ultimately connect to.
What do you think is important for people to know about Nadia Turner as a specific character?
Right. I mean, I think she is a character who, immediately after losing her mother in this really sudden and traumatic way, finds herself in the position where she might become somebody else's mother. And to me, that was a really essential thing about that character, and ultimately weighs into the decision that she makes. You know, I think that people make choices that are, you know, that we may or may not agree with from the outside, but I think it's always important to consider why somebody might make a choice and to try to put ourselves in their position for a little bit and consider where they're coming from.
The title of the novel, The Mothers, I mean, I think people can already get some hints of why it might be called that. But there is actually a group of characters referred to as the Mothers throughout the novel. Can you explain who they are?
Right. So the Mothers are the Church Mothers, which is this chorus of elderly women at the church that's at the center of the book, who kind of observe and comment on the lives of the younger characters. They're sort of all seeing and seemingly all knowing. And I was really interested in the role of church mothers, as far as they are these women who are often honored, but kind of dismissed, and, you know, often I think are not seen as having a lot of real institutional power in the way that a pastor might, or whoever is making a lot of the decisions for the church might have that real power. So I was interested in these older women who are kind of overlooked, but end up having the ultimate power in the book because they are the ones who get to shape the narrative for of the characters like Nadia and her friends, but also the church itself.
You know, there's a part where these mothers have been, they're sent prayer requests, and they receive a request from Nadia's father. She lives alone with her father, and he loves his truck, and she's in some ways in competition with the truck for his attention and affection. The church mothers become aware that there's something sort of off when his truck has been crashed, because he wouldn't be careless with his truck. And they receive then secondarily this request from him that says, pray for her. And they're not sure whether the request is to pray for Nadia or for his deceased wife. And there's this moment where they realize that they've never thought about this young girl and what she's going through. They've really focused their empathy and compassion on the dad.
And right.
You had said that you're writing about characters like the people you know in a place like where you grew up. Is this referring to something in your own background, in your own frame of reference?
No. It was all just coming out of the space of growing up in the church. I spent a lot of time in church when I was a kid. My mom's actually Catholic and my dad is Protestant. So I spent time between all these different church traditions. So I think I've always been really interested in the role of faith communities, and particularly the ways in which churches can be these huge sources of support and community, but also can be sources of condemnation and judgment. I think in the case of Nadia, there's a way in which the fact that her mother has committed suicide is considered a very odd and shameful and sinful thing within this church community. So I think that is also another way in which she struggles. You know, if her mother had died of cancer, for example, she would not have also had to bear that additional stigma and shame of losing her mother in this way that is condemned by the church. So I think I'm interested in how that the way that this church, you know, could have been a more supportive community for her in the immediate aftermath of her deep personal tragedy, but in a lot of ways kind of overlooks her and even judges her for rebelling in the wake of her loss.
It seems like a lot of the older women characters in this book are written as sort of possible mothers that Nadia, in a way, tries out. I mean, whether she sort of realizes that or not, even a nurse, you know, as she's going under for this procedure, she accidentally calls the nurse, mom, you know. And how was it for you to write about women characters all as potential, like, actors cast in the role of mother?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something that definitely I discovered later into the draft of writing it, because there were different relationships I was kind of interested in Nadia exploring. But I realized, I think, you know, when you're writing a book, you essentially want to think to yourself what that character wants or what they need. And that's really what she wants the whole book, is she wants a mother, and she's lost hers in this really unexpected and sudden way, and she can never get that relationship back. So she looks to people like the pastor's wife, or like her best friend Aubrey's sister, or these other women who kind of pop in her life. She looks for them to fulfill a role that none of them ultimately can fulfill.
I hear that you started writing this novel when you yourself were a teenager.
Yes, I was about 17 or 18 when I was working on the first draft.
That's incredible. What So, yeah, I mean, when you say that you didn't realize you were writing these things about this character until later drafts, I mean, you are 17 years old yourself writing this novel. Do you think that it would be the book it is if you had, like, started it as an adult? Same plot, same characters?
Right. No, I don't think so. And I think there are some parts of the book I could only write when I was a little bit older.
Like what?
You know, at 17, like I'd never had my heart broken, you know, so I'd never really experienced that, like, type of someone disappointing you in this way. I didn't understand the sort of post-college malaise that Nadia kind of finds herself in, where she's wondering, you know, should I move back home and be closer to my family? Should I go and do all these things? A lot of those experiences were things I had to get a little bit older to see. And I think also just the idea of the church mothers, that older voice. I just wasn't that interested in this older generation. When I was 17, I was only interested in these young teenage characters who were my age. But I think that at the same time, the ways in which I was able to write those young characters, you know, that sort of anticipation and the fear when you're about to leave for college, that first crush, the ways in which she has this, you know, huge, really important friendship with Aubrey, that the closeness of that friendship when you are in high school, which I think is hard to duplicate as you get older. Those were all things that I think would not have existed in that way if I had written them when I was a bit older.
When were you in high school? I mean, how long ago are we talking about?
I graduated from high school in 2008.
So that's one of the things that I thought was really cool, was the way that technology and especially phones kind of are used in this book. It's not, there's nothing deliberate about it, but that's part of what I like. It seems like when you get novels by older authors, and this makes sense, either it is as though people have not yet adopted the cell phone, like it just doesn't exist, or else it exists in this sort of really drawing a lot of attention to itself kind of way. But this is a piece of technology that has changed how we live in a really, and especially how young people live. So for these characters to be believable, it almost had to be written by someone your age if it's dealing with teenagers who are supposed to exist today.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, you can't, like you're saying, you can't ignore the technology. And there's a lot of ways in which the technology kind of can sometimes reduce the drama of really classic plots. But there, you know, there's a moment where Luke is kind of wondering what has come of Nadia. And I was just like, well, obviously he's going to go on Facebook and look, you know, it seemed to me very obvious that that's what you would do at this time. If you're wondering what happened to your ex, you're, you know, this idea that you can pretend as if that technology doesn't exist, and if that wouldn't be a way to get a window into the life of someone you're wondering about, to me that felt really false and unrealistic. So I don't like it when you're, like you're saying, when the technology kind of overshadows the book. That gets obnoxious, but it's part of life.
We will continue our discussion with author Britt Bennett when KCUR's Central Standard returns, and we'll get back a little bit into this conversation we started earlier about race. If you want to talk to Britt about race in literature, call 816-235-2888. Let us know whether you think characters of color get to just be characters, or will they represent their race no matter what? I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with author Britt Bennett about her new novel, The Mothers. It's getting a lot of buzz. It's her debut novel. She's written a lot of essays before, and we're about to talk about those, actually. But this novel has been called a modern novel about abortion and race, whereas it sounds, Britt, like you might describe it differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I don't know, it features those aspects, but yeah, I think it's essentially, I think of it as a novel that's about relationships between and among women. I think the central relationship in the book is the friendship between Nadia and Aubrey, who are both these motherless girls who find connection through their loss.
And kind of unexpected connection.
Right, absolutely. They both kind of they judge each other, and they both have things that they envy about each other's life and things that they misunderstand about each other's life, and huge secrets that they both keep from each other, which ultimately have implications in their friendship.
Yeah. And Nadia is kind of seen from the outside as a wilder girl, and Aubrey maybe as, I don't know,
Goody two shoes.
Yeah. That's nicer than the words that were popping into my head.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I think that, yeah, that's definitely the reputations they have. But also they when they get to know each other, they realize that they have a lot more in common than they might have guessed.
So this novel, which you started as a teenager and then kind of reworked pretty intensely as an adult.
Yes.
You don't see this as being about race. It happens to be set in a community where most of the characters are Black. But you have written essays about race, and I'm interested in talking to you about how that is different than just happening to set a story in a community where you're depicting that community.
Well, I mean, I think I'm still thinking through this, but I think that question of being about race, it's, you know, it's like everything is about race in a sense, you know? It's not that it necessarily the characters happen to be Black. It's like I chose them. You know, I made all the choices that happened in the book. So I decided to set it in a Black community, and I wanted to write about Black characters. But, you know, it's like we all live in racialized bodies. We all have racialized experiences. I think about a show like, you know, like Sex and the City. Like, that's as much a show that's about race as, you know, a show like Atlanta or a show like Insecure.
Explain that. Like, it's about white people.
Right, it's about whiteness. It's like you're setting a show in New York and you're focusing on upper class white women. Those are all choices, you know. Those are choices to explore some aspect, and maybe you're, you know, that's not happening as consciously as the ways in which people of color are exploring race. But that's still that's advancing a type of vision about race, a vision that's extremely unrealistic if you've ever been in any city, let alone New York.
I think it makes a little bit of an assumption about who the reader is.
Right. I mean, I just think, you know, I think that question of about race, it's, you know, there are novels that, that, you know, are only focused on white characters. That those are novels that are about race, you know? So I think that's the thing, is we need to decenter whiteness in a way that we need to make whiteness visible, because I think that there is a way in which it is invisible, in a way that often maleness is invisible, in a way that straightness is invisible. Those are modes of advancing power by sort of being able to kind of decenter your identity and making it seem as if your identity is just standard or normal.
Yeah, like,
and everybody else's is kind of other, but it's an identity as much as all of us have identities.
Yeah, like if the main character is a woman, then it's chicklet.
Exactly. You know, versus, oh, if the main character is a man, then what? It's just fiction, you know? So I think that to me is something that's important to think about. I like to identify the race of all the characters in the book. You know, I don't want to write a man walked into the room, because I know that if I write that, then the reader will assume that that man is white.
You're writing about, you've got to make people be able to picture that character.
Right. Right. And even it doesn't necessarily matter for the plot whether that man is white or Black or Latino. Even if it doesn't matter, to me, it's important to specify that, because of this assumption we have in our culture, which is that whoever is standard or whoever who's normal and whoever gets to just be a person, quote unquote, that those are people who are in positions of power compared to people who have more marginalized identities.
You know, I want to talk to you about an essay you wrote, and this is an essay that you wrote in 2014, so it's been a while, but it's in Jezebel, and it has, let's see, as of today, like 1.6 million views.
Right.
It's called I Don't Know What to Do with Good White People. Can you tell us about the idea in that essay?
Well, the essay was written in the winter of 2014, I believe, which was when there was sort of that string of back-to-back non-indictments of the policemen who killed Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And I think what I was essentially thinking about was whether it matters if white people intend to do well, if the end result is still Black death. I was really struck by the fact that the officer who killed Michael Brown said that there was nothing he could have done to change things. And the officer who killed Eric Garner expressed regret. But the end result is that both of those men are still dead. So does it matter at the end of the day that those are different, perhaps different motivations, perhaps different, end feelings? So it's something that I was thinking about. I think the essay is filled with questions and not so much answers. I still have people today, very well-meaning white people, who will write me and ask, "How can I be a good white person?" And I don't have the answer for that, and I don't know if anyone really has the answer for that right now. I think we're all asking these questions, but something that I think about, because as a person, I like to be empathetic. I like to believe that people generally mean well, even when they do bad things or they do harmful things. But I also was just wondering, what's the value of good intentions if the result is still harm?
You, with that many views, I mean, has that, what do you think it is about this essay that stands out? Because people have said and written so much in response to those
Right.
moments in our recent history, and many similar moments that have followed.
Right.
What is
I
it
mean, I
about?
think, right. I think part of it is the questioning nature of the essay. I don't think it's didactic. I had some people who just kind of had this knee-jerk reaction to the essay because of that title, and responded very angrily, in a way that I think is not actually engaging with the actual text, which I don't think is necessarily accusatory or didactic or in any type of way. So I think, one, it's not an essay that tries to tell you what to think. It just raises questions for you to think about. And I think that that's something that is different than a lot of the writing, particularly happening on the internet right now. So I think that's one thing. I think there's also a way in which it's kind of personal. I talk in the essay about an experience my father had when he was young, where he was wrongfully pulled over and had a gun pointed at his head when he was coming home from Bible study, even though at the time he worked for the DA's office. But he was, close to being, I mean, he, and there's so many ways in which that story could have ended differently. And in any way that that story ended, with my father being shot, I would not be here. So there's a way in which I think that personal aspect of that essay, also puts it in a different perspective than some of the other writing happening right now.
Yeah, you start with the observation that you've been around good white people all your life and kind of explore some what seems like pressure you feel to be grateful for that,
Right.
based on what previous generations of your family have experienced. Can you, I just for our listeners who haven't read the essay, can you talk people through a little bit like what you're wrestling with about being surrounded by good white people?
Right. I mean, I think about, my mother grew up in Louisiana during Jim Crow. I remember her telling me this story about her younger sister, who was friends with this white doctor's son, and the son wanted to come over and hang out at the house. And her mother was so terrified that something would happen if people saw this white boy at the house, that, they could be attacked by the Klan. I think about things like that, and I think about the fact that, I had white friends over all the time hanging out. I went to a school where I had teachers who were really supportive of me, who were overwhelmingly white. I eventually went to Stanford for college, which is, a super white liberal space. I think about a lot of that in context to, my mother, who, they couldn't even try on shoes in a store. Like, they had to measure their foot with a piece of string and bring the string to a store because you were not allowed to try on shoes if you were black. So when I think about a lot of that, there's a way in which I'm like, whoa, I'm the only generation of my family that would never think twice about inviting a white friend over, or think that
Or trying on
I
shoes.
could, be the Right, or trying on shoes. I would never think about any of those things. And I feel fortunate for that when I think about what it has meant to be black in this country. But at the same time, I think about the shortcomings of white liberalism and the ways in which people who often, like, will share my politics a lot, or will profess to believe a lot of the same things about racial equality, often still have those moments where they can't necessarily see past their racial privilege, or where they act in these ways that are harmful, even though on the surface they are pleasant, and they're not going to harm me in a way that my mother feared about being harmed by white people.
Can I read just a little snippet from this essay?
Sure.
Because I think it's something that remains relevant. You say, over the past 2 weeks, I've seen good white people congratulate themselves for deleting racist friends or debating family members or performing small acts of kindness to black people. Sometimes I think I'd prefer racist trolling to this grade of self-aggrandizement. Can you talk about that? I mean, just race and attitudes toward race in social media, in that particular kind of space.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of this came, I remember the essay actually came from seeing this person I had gone to school with who was congratulating herself for not calling the police on these black kids who lived in her neighborhood who would throw parties. And she was like, I don't call the police because I know that some bad things could happen if the police got there to these black kids. And I remember seeing that and just thinking like, my God, you know, we live in a college town. Like, people are throwing parties all the time. You know, the idea that you deserve some type of medal for not calling the police on these kids who are being obnoxious because they're black, that you think that that is sort of this act of heroism that we should all applaud you for. And seeing, you know, a bunch of this person's friends who are also white, you know, compliment her for this and applaud her for that. That was something that made me actually really frustrated to see that this is what was happening and online in the space of some white people I knew. And then I'm looking on the other side of, you know, my Twitter timeline or Facebook and seeing all of my black friends who were just feeling so much despair and hopelessness at that moment. So I think there was a way in which I get frustrated by people who think that being decent requires some type of congratulations, particularly when you think of like how long and complicated racial history has been in this country. You know, it's not enough just to say, you know, oh, I'm not going to call the police on black kids when they play their music loudly. That's not enough when you think about how far we still need to come to gain racial equality in this country and to eliminate all the racial injustice that happens every day.
Are you working on anything now or other than traveling the country doing readings for your novel The Mother, which has to be really time consuming, but are there ideas that you're kind of turning over in your head and working with right now?
I think so. I mean, I'm working the next novel for sure, and not literally right now while I've been traveling, but I've been working on that. But I think, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to be American right now. I think, you know, we're in a really fraught political moment and a moment of intense polarization politically. And at the same time, in the past 3 or 4 months, I've traveled to more of America than I ever had in my life. I've seen more of the country and met people in all these different places. And even particularly now in this leg of the tour, I've been sent to mostly places that are red states versus the sort of before the election, I went to a lot of the blue states. So it's been really interesting to talk to people about this book, which in a lot of ways, you know, is a political book or is a book that invokes politics in ways that can be polarizing. But at the same time, to talk to people from so many different communities and so many different backgrounds and see the ways in which people are relating to this book.
Well, can I just jump
in? In spite of politics, has been interesting.
And ask you more about that. I mean,
sure.
What has surprised you in particular about the reception you got in a particular place, just given maybe what you were hearing about places like that in the news?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like I grew up in California. I went to school in Michigan, but I lived in Ann Arbor, which is a liberal town, liberal college town. So I spent a lot of my life in these, you know, sort of blue spaces. And, you know, I think when you think of a topic like abortion, it's such a controversial topic and a topic that when you look at the politics of it seems very polarizing. But I think that
just to remind people, that's the one of the things your novel addresses. Go on.
Right. It's one of the topics addressed in the novel. And I think it was something that I felt a little nervous about, not knowing if there were going to be people, you know, people bomb abortion clinics, you know, there are people who feel really strong ways about this topic. So there was a way in which when I realized how I was going to tour a lot and go talk to a lot of different people about this topic that is very polarizing and emotional and political and fraught, I felt a little nervous about that. But I think the thing that has been really surprising and honestly really really encouraging has just been people of all political affiliations have talked to me about the book. I had one person who told me her mother was a pro-life person who lived in Dallas who really loved the book. And she loved the book because she identified with a character in the book who regrets the abortion very deeply. So she identified with that position. I've had a lot of clergy reach out to me, actually. I had a priest in Texas who told me that he loved the book, and another minister who said that they wanted their church Bible study to read the book. So I think it's been telling that people in real life have much more complicated and diverse opinions about a topic like abortion than our politics would suggest.
Britt Bennett, author of The Mothers, will be giving a talk at the Plaza branch of the public library this Wednesday evening. Britt Bennett, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And tomorrow, we're going to hear about the opioid epidemic from a different perspective. We have not heard much about what might be alternatives for living with pain. So that's what we're going to do tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.